Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Tonight we'll have open lines. The last 2 weeks have been absolutely phenomenal. 2 weeks ago we were at the James Gilliland Ranch / Sanctuary in Trout Lake, Washington with the Science, Spirit and Earth Transformation Conference. This was the third annual conference and it was so very well done and the weather was perfect and the speakers were phenomenal and the people were wonderful. If you get a chance to make it out there next year, we highly recommend it. We'll do some promotion for that. Might have another one this fall, just to be sure that everybody got the message. Again, I want to mention that open lines all night tonight, USA and Canada toll-free, 888-228-4494. Canada, we also have a toll-free number for you, 877-489-6350. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us at 530-776-5154 or 5185. And if you're on Skype, we didn't leave you out either. You can reach us at BBS Radio. And at PalTalk, you can reach us at BBSRadio_com. The solar wind tonight is a mild 292.9 kilometers per second, but the proton density is up slightly to 3.9 protons per cubic centimeter. The reason we watch this, and you can write them down on your refrigerator each week, is as we get closer to 2012, we expect that proton density to climb sharply, maybe by a factor of 10. Sunspot 1000, a leftover from solar cycle 23, is barely visible. There is a small coronal hole facing Earth and might result in aurora borealis on the 23rd or 24th, so watch out for it. Solar scientists are wondering if solar cycle 24 will ever restart. Wouldn't it be strange if the much-awaited cycle never started? If you thought levitation was impossible, wait until you hear this. Circus acts and movie special effects may never be the same again. If an idea for an invisible cable made of carbon nanotubes works out, being narrower than the wavelength of light, nanotubes are normally invisible, as long as they are separated by more than one wavelength. Now, Nicola Pugno of the Polytechnic of Turin in Italy has calculated how many nanotubes would be needed to support a person, taking into account small defects that develop in the tubes during manufacturing. When held 5 micrometers apart, that's 5 millionths of a meter apart, to keep them invisible, they would form a cable only 1 centimeter, that's about 1/2 inch in diameter, weighing a mere 10 milligrams per kilometer. That's very light. So that's how much a cable would weigh that could support a person, and you wouldn't even see it, because light would not reflect off of it. How about that? You think there might be some new applications for that. Call us up tonight and let us know. Now, if you read The Arc of Millions of Years, you would know that a planet's magnetic field can be turned on and off like a light switch. An asteroid could have done just that to Mars 4 billion years ago. Maybe less. Mars once had a magnetic field, which may have been driven by a dynamo formed from the convection of material in the core, much like they believe Earth is today. Yet crater records suggest the Martian dynamo died quickly, suddenly, over a few tens of thousands of years, a mere weekend, cosmologically speaking. Something researchers struggle to explain. Imagine that. Now, Jatar Arkani Hamed of the University of Toronto, Canada, and colleagues say the gravitational tug of an orbiting asteroid or a close passing planet may have powered a dynamo by pulling on the fluid of Mars' core. The team's lab and model simulations showed that an asteroid orbiting 75,000 kilometers above Mars could have maintained a dynamo for over 400 million years before the rock crashed into the planet and switched it off. Now, that's one theory of how magnetic fields turn on and off. The other is that a close pass by a planet suddenly would synchronize the core and the crust, thus removing the difference in spin. And since we know metal moving through a magnetic field is what generates electric current, and vice versa, the magnetic field, the magnetosphere around Mars, would completely disappear. Recently, we had some feedback on a film project that myself and Brent Miller and his son and his organization Intuitive Research came up with called the Horizon Project. And this feedback was pretty positive. This was kind of a professional risk for us to take, to go out a couple of years ago and say that the possibility of a polar shift was more than just a passing fancy. We started putting some documentation, some history behind it, some mathematical models behind it, made it understandable for the layman, and produced a film called The Horizon Project. You can get it by going to the website at x2-radio.com, clicking on the banner at the bottom, and it will take you directly to the website where The Horizon Project can be obtained and viewed. It's really well produced, and it does present the idea that Earth's poles, the North and South poles, could switch. It's not so outlandish, as I will explain to you in just a moment. What does that mean? It means that somehow the flux lines between the core and the crust will reverse themselves, that the North Pole will become the South Pole, and likewise the South Pole will become the North Pole. And does this mean that the actual rotation of the crust will reverse? Well, it could. It just depends on how it happens. If, by some chaotic coincidence, the core should happen to roll over inside the crust, and of course the core, being very, very dense, is going to continue its momentum in the same direction, but it would be in the opposite direction of the crust, which would mean the magnetosphere would increase in strength many, many, many fold, and then the crust would slow to a stop, and then it would slowly begin rotating in the other direction. Which means instead of the sun rising in the east, it would indeed rise in the west. And history shows that that's exactly how the Earth was anciently formed. That the sun rose over the coast of California, not over the coast of Florida. Sound outlandish? Maybe not. In February of 2001, a scientist issued a paper. It says you can't tell by looking, but scientists say the sun has just undergone an important change. This was in February of 2001. Our star's magnetic field has flipped. The sun's magnetic north pole, which was in the northern hemisphere just a few months ago, now points south. It's a topsy-turvy situation, but not an unexpected one. Quote, this always happens around this time of solar maximum, says David Hathaway, a solar physicist at the Marshall Space Flight Center. The magnetic poles exchange places at the peak of the sunspot cycle. In fact, it's a good indication that the solar maximum is really here. Well, right now, we are at a solar minimum. Hardly any sunspots at all, and the ones that do appear are equatorial, very weak, and positively or forward polarized. We know that solar cycle number 23 just recently started back in February. But the interesting thing about it is, although we had a few high-latitude reverse polarized sunspots, indicating that solar cycle 23 had in fact begun, they suddenly stopped. We haven't had a reverse polarized high-latitude sunspot in several months. So has it started, or has it not started? Well, let's read on. The sun's magnetic poles will remain as they are right now at our solar minimum, with the north magnetic pole pointing toward the sun's southern hemisphere until, you guessed it, the year 2012, when they will reverse again. This happens to be the time when Earth will line up with a very thin, very gravitational powerful plane that happens to line up with a supermassive spinning black hole in the center of the Milky Way galaxy. Now, interesting thing about black holes, you know, they just kind of came into being about Einstein's time. We started talking about what would happen if enough gravity gathered in one spot where the gravity became so intense that even photons of light could not escape it. And the idea of a Big Bang or a instantaneous beginning of the universe because of the microwave hum that was heard to be equal in all directions around the Earth. Many theories sprang up and started to gain popularity. In fact, they're routinely taught in high schools and colleges all around the world. But are they true? Are they accurate? Well, we're beginning to learn a little bit more. We're making some general assumptions now that seem to hold water, and that one is that there is a supermassive spinning black hole at the center of every significant galaxy. Now, smaller galaxies can probably hold themselves together just by the group gravitational pull of the stars in it. But larger galaxies, like the Milky Way galaxy, the Andromeda galaxy, and other large galaxies, need to have some central gravitational point around which to rotate. Well, as it turns out, when you consider conservation of momentum, let's just talk a little bit about that. If you've ever been on a merry-go-round and really give it a spin with someone sitting in the middle of the merry-go-round, they don't really feel a lot of centrifugal force, do they, sitting in the middle? They just get dizzy. But let them slide down one of the legs of that merry-go-round and then see the force that they feel slinging them to the outside. But you'll also notice something else. The merry-go-round slows down. Because of conservation of momentum, there's only so much energy in the system of the merry-go-round. When the person moves toward the outer ring of the merry-go-round has to compensate by slowing down, because so much energy is going into the body that's moving. Likewise, if you give it a really run that merry-go-round around the outside and then grab onto the outer rail, and if you've got enough strength, move yourself into the center. As you do that, the merry-go-round will go faster and faster and faster. One can see this easily in just a few months when you start watching the Olympics. Watch the ice skaters when they begin to spin. They pull their arms and legs into the center, making them spin faster and faster and faster, because the system of their spinning body has to maintain the same amount of energy. It has to conserve it. Galaxies do exactly the same thing. Now, mathematically, it's always been thought, well, not always, up until recently it's been thought, that black holes are perfectly round. But there are a couple of assumptions that we have recently made that make it a different possibility possible. And it's this. For a long time, we thought that black holes were smooth as a black marble. No hair, no mountains, no stalagmites sticking out on the outside. That the gravitational field was smooth and uniform, and the event horizon, that's the point of no return for the light and matter and energy on the inside of the black hole, is pretty uniform all around the outside. But then we started doing some calculations. Well, gee, what happens if the black hole absorbs more matter from its surroundings? What happens if it swallows a few more suns? What happens to the size of the black hole? As it turns out, the surface area of the event horizon, well, let's just call it the skin of that black marble, it doesn't really increase that much. But the chaos inside the black hole increases exponentially. And, of course, momentum has to be conserved, right? We just talked about that. That means that the black hole is spinning at its mathematical maximum. Now, you might think, well, gee, how fast can a black hole spin? I mean, Earth revolves once every 24 hours, right? Give or take a little bit. Well, would you believe me if I told you that black holes and binary neutron stars, these highly gravitational bodies that are falling in on one another, would you believe me if I told you they rotate as much as 1,000 to 3,000 times a second? That's really fast, especially when you consider something about 50, 60, 70,000 suns worth of matter. In the middle of our galaxy, there may be 100 million suns worth of matter inside a supermassive spinning black hole. Well, a funny thing happens when the mass of these black holes gets that large. They don't stay spherical anymore. They begin flattening out like a donut, like a big dinner plate, like a saucer. And when they do that, some mighty effects begin to take place. We have a caller on the line. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from.
Hi, Dr. Agnew. This is Mark from Davenport, Ohio.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
I'm doing real good. I heard you on Coast to Coast recently, and I thought that show was outstanding. I've listened to that over and over again.
Well, I appreciate that. One of these days we'll get X Squared Radio as big as Coast to Coast. But for now, George Nuri is the best there is, don't you think?
Yeah, but you know, I think you were the best guest on 2012 that he's had so far. I really like the way you described that tunnel or corridor that goes from the center of the galaxy all the way out near our solar system. And I wondered if you could kind of review exactly what happens as we kind of pass through that gravity tunnel around 2012.
Yeah, you bet, you bet. In fact, we've laid a good 50-minute foundation for it. Right now we're talking about supermassive spinning black holes. And I'll tell you, Mark, it's kind of interesting when we look at these computer models that we're able to do now, which we weren't really able to do 5 years ago. At least the general public wasn't able to do them. What happens when you spin a body that's got more matter in it than a human could imagine, something like 100 million suns worth of matter inside of it, is it begins to flatten out like a dinner plate, like a really thin CD disc. And when you look at the layout of the galaxy, especially the Milky Way galaxy, the energy shape of the galaxy matches that theory, because the Milky Way galaxy lays out a lot like a big saucer with a bulge in the middle, right?
Right.
So what basically happens is inside the event horizon, that's the part we can't see from the outside, inside there, the chaos, the amount of uncertainty inside that area is unbelievable. At one time, we thought that black holes would form and everything would be about the size of a proton and all the universe would be crunched into the size of a proton. But then Clerk Maxwell started doing some math, and then better mathematicians than him, start doing algebraic divisions of the uncertainty inside the event horizon. And guess what we found? We found that the singularity obeys the rules of the Heisenberg uncertainty, which basically means you cannot locate the speed and the location of the singularity at the same time. You can do one or the other, but you can't do both. Mathematically, it's impossible. So if that's the case, we made an assumption, and it seems to be holding true, that the matter...
Hello?
And it begins the inside of that event horizon. It can't escape, but it also can't reach the center. Now, if this black hole has a diameter of what we think it does, somewhere around 6 or 7 light years across, that means that 99% of the matter inside that black hole is smashed up against a circle 6 to 7 light years across. And the vast distance across the center of it has nothing. There's nothing to run into. Now, this is the amazing thing. You remember a structure called the Einstein-Rosen Bridge?
Yes.
Well, Einstein, you know, in those days, math was done with a slide rule. And he made some interesting drawings, some interesting graphics, and they looked a little bit like a tornado or a cone. You start with a single point, and then it slowly increases in diameter and then flares out at the end, right? Well, late in the 70s, we started connecting these together, and that's where we came up with the idea of wormholes. And then Stephen Hawking and Kip Thorne, both wonderful pioneers in the area of physics. Kip Thorne took a huge professional risk. Of course, he had been successful in raising money for the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, so he could probably stand it. But he wrote a book called Black Holes and Time Warps. And he made an assumption in this book that time travel was actually possible, although impossible. And here's what he meant by that. He said a wormhole could be formed, but it would have to be built with exotic material, meaning it would have to be built with material from a neutron star, which are not very readily available around here. And it would have to be constructed from the inside out, like held open like framework, right? Well, the problem is that once you open this wormhole and you connect two places in the universe, is you get what's called a vacuum fluctuation, which is a little bit like sticking your microphone up against your stereo speaker and turning the volume all the way up. You know what would happen, don't you?
It doesn't sound like it would be a good thing.
No, you get a horrible feedback, you know. You've heard it at some concerts where
right.
The guy gets his microphone too close to the stage monitor, and the first 6 rows of people go deaf for the next 3 weeks. Well, fortunately, the amplifier clips. It can't generate any more power, so it just reaches a point of no return, and it either destroys the amplifier, or that's the maximum sound that it can make, which is, of course, well above the threshold of human tolerance. But black holes, when you open up a wormhole, there's no such thing as this clipping. And so vibrations occur that actually shatter the black hole. Right?
Yeah.
Okay, now the interesting thing about this is you just crossed parsecs of space in a matter of seconds, way faster than the speed of light, which means you actually traveled back in time. They did this, it's called the cue ball paradox. You throw a cue ball through the wormhole from one side to the other, the person catches it on the other side and throws it back through to you.
Mm-hmm.
It travels so fast that it actually arrives before it left.
That's strange.
That's the paradox. That's the paradox. So these vacuum fluctuations end up destroying the wormhole before it ever forms. And so Kip Thorne came to the conclusion that although mathematically possible, it is not very probable that a black hole could open a wormhole. However, the assumption was made that the black hole or the neutron material would open the wormhole from the inside. What we published in the first volume of The Arc of Millions of Years was a theory based on the Heisenberg uncertainty of these black holes and the fact that the singularity is kind of flying around the inside of that black hole like bees instead of a single dot in the middle. It means that the wormhole opens from the outside, not the inside, and it can thus be stable for billions of years. So when you get a window, go ahead.
So do you believe there's going to be a wormhole that opens up?
I think there probably are. Yeah, I think there are already wormholes that are open in space, but they're invisible. You can't really see them because they suck in all light. We also know that as Earth gets very close to this very thin axis of intense gravity that comes out of the black hole from the center of our galaxy, lots of things are going to happen to this planet and to the people and sentient beings on it. You know, let's just talk about a couple of them. Well, first of all, let me answer your question about, you know, what would happen to an Earth if you tossed it through a black hole like that? You remember
right.
a movie called The Black Hole with the Maximilian Schell? And as they were falling into the black hole, everything gets stretched out and pulled apart, and it takes forever and ever to go through the black hole, and you end up being destroyed, right?
Sure.
That's called tidal gravity. The moon does that to Earth every day. In fact, there's a full moon last night, and as the moon goes around the Earth, or the Earth revolves, the moon actually stretches the Earth, and the oceans move around the Earth based on that tidal gravity. That's why they're called tides. Well, black holes do the same thing to bodies if the gravity is located in one spot. But if the gravity is 5.5 light years away, or the mass is 5 light years away, but you've got this intense curvature of space taking place, then a planet could pass through great distances of time and space, which time is just distance, you know, without being harmed, with no tidal damage whatsoever. Now, you know what would happen to this Earth if it was knocked out of our orbit around our sun. What would happen to it?
Well, it would probably get pretty cold or pretty hot.
You bet.
And the other thing you talked about was these global superstorms that might
right.
occur.
Right.
And how confident are you that this will occur?
Well, I'll cover that. Let me just cover that in a second. I'm going to talk
okay.
about weather in about 10 minutes, but let's
okay.
finish this point. So, you're right. Earth, if it was slung away from the sun for longer than about a week, it would get pretty darn cold, wouldn't it?
Sure.
I mean, we get cold snaps from time to time in the summertime, but Earth holds a lot of thermal energy. I mean, we go 12 to 16 hours with no sunlight, right? But we bounce right back the next day. So Earth could probably last 4 or 5 days if it was knocked out of the sun's orbit. If it was going to move from one point in our galaxy to this point, or from another galaxy to here, or from another dimension to here, it would have to do so pretty quickly, wouldn't it?
Yep.
Now, in the historical record, and I mean records from Judeo-Christian records, the Quran, the Popol Vuh, the Kabbalah, the Sefer Yetzirah, which is one of the oldest books on the earth, they all speak about an event that happened a long time ago during a flood, a global flood event, in which there was a day, a night, and a day with no sunshine, and the fountains of the earth opened, and all this water came pouring in on the planet, right?
Right.
That event took place cataclysmically, really fast. It took about 5 days for that flood to just completely wipe out everything on the planet, according to the Bible. And then it took 7 months for it to stabilize and settle down enough where Noah's boat came to rest on Mount Ararat. if you want to take that record as literal, right?
Sure.
That would be consistent with moving a planet from one place to another place and settling it back into an orbit around a new sun. A planet could do that.
So, are you saying that during the flood we actually moved to a new location in space?
If you read the first volume of The Ark of Millions of Years, there's a chapter called The Union of the Polarity.
Okay.
It actually talks about two Earths. One, a higher vibrational planet called a spirit Earth, if you will, and the other, a lower vibrational planet called a temporal Earth, both of which had races of humans on them. One was, in some records, called Lower Adam, and on the other was called Higher Adam, or Adam Kadmon, which was Adam through Noah. The two races came together during that event, and they were introduced to one another. And we are the genetic result of that event. Now, I've had
That's
people
mind boggling.
Yeah, how in the world could there be two Earths occupying the same place? Now, that's
right.
A real easy question for a physicist to answer, because there's a lot of space in our Earth. Did you know that a neutrino could travel through a solid light year of Earth without striking anything? That's how full of space the matter is on our Earth.
That's kind of hard to wrap your mind around, you know. That's
yeah, I know what you mean. Well, okay, think of it this way. You have a 5-gallon bucket, and you've packed it as full of marbles as you possibly could. And then
okay.
You pour in 3 gallons of water. The water fills in the gap between the marbles. Now, the water is very liquid, very high energy, and the glass of the marble is very solid and very low energy. You have two Earths occupying the same space at the same time.
Now, do you feel pretty confident that this is, in fact, true right now?
Well, yes, I do, and I'll tell you why. Because we have a wonderful tool that's still operating out in space called the Hubble Telescope. And guess what we routinely look at and photograph all the time? Binary neutron stars that are coalescing. Two stars that are dancing around each other like ice skaters holding hands, and they're going to form a new star together. Now, that happens all the time. And if stars can do it, then planets can do it.
Wow. That is really amazing.
Well,
so
it is amazing. Go ahead.
Well, you're taking the point of view that there's literally another Earth that occupies almost the same space that we are in?
The same circumference, yes. I think the two are of different mass makeups. They're of different ages. They may have been created by the same supernova event, but it's pretty clear that they weren't. Supernova events are the cosmological creators of matter. What happens is a sun goes into supernova, and in the diameter of that explosion, all the matter is turned into pure energy, and then eventually turns into new matter as it collapses from wave function to particle function. The interesting thing about all this higher order matter is it's all entangled. That means that the particles, the subatomic particles that are in spin around the nuclei of these atoms, are all entangled. If I grab a electron on an ion and I reverse its spin electromagnetically, its sister particle, it could be 11 kilometers away. This has been proven time and time again. That particle will reverse spin instantaneously because the matter is entangled. We don't understand it, but it sure is repeatable.
Wow.
But
these two Earths that reside in the same space, their actual molecules are entangled in some way, yet we're not aware of the other Earth's existence. We don't physically see it. We don't hear it. Is that what you're describing?
well, we probably do see it, and we probably do experience it. Let me give you another example. Take a look in the mirror, and what do you see? You see a human body. It's mobile, it's self-aware, it's self-healing, it can eat practically anything. Usually, it eats just matter from this planet, which makes up the molecules and structure of that body. All the calcium and proteins and everything are made from local peas and carrots, right?
Sure.
But that's not really you. You are the higher energy form inside of that body, occupying the same space.
Okay, that makes sense.
Okay, the Earth is the same way. It has a higher energy portion of it, which occupies the same space and, if you want to go to this stretch, gives it its personality, gives it its life. And the rest of it is just peas and carrots. It's just the calcium and protein and minerals that make up the Earth. Now, the interesting thing is not all the matter of the Earth is entangled, which means two different origins, two different supernova events.
Wow.
Kind of expands your mind, doesn't it?
It's kind of overwhelming. In the Billy Meyer material, according to the Plejarans, there is, or the Pleiadians, however you want to refer to them as, there's actually what they call fine matter, and then there's the regular matter that we see. And so that kind of corresponds kind of with what you're talking about, that this finer matter is residing kind of almost in the same space, so to
yes,
speak.
Yes, it's not necessarily quasi-dimensional. In other words, it's not like fairy matter or pixie dust. It is,
sure,
it is real three-dimensional matter for now, but it is vibrating at a higher frequency level, and it appears as though the two Earths are now becoming dissident to one another. In other words, they're no longer in perfect harmony. They're beginning to wobble against each other. So what makes that wobble happen is the nearness, the proximity, as we go through the precession, the 12 star systems that make up our zodiac, as the Earth, as our solar system rotates through the precession, which is a 26,000-year zodiac. We're ending the year of Pisces and beginning to start the age of Pisces and beginning to start the age of Aquarius. We're nearing that galactic plane where we line up with this very intense gravitational field coming from the center of our galaxy. It appears, at least from the historical record from past civilizations, each time we do this, about every 2160 years, there's a cataclysm of some kind. A continent disappears.
So is the Earth already starting to wobble on its axis?
Absolutely.
Is this a measurable phenomenon that scientists are starting to see?
It is a measurable phenomenon. We're doing it from space right now. It has been done locally with magnetometers from submarines. But just recently, and I mean recently, like the year 2006, the Arctic regions have opened up due to global warming. And some people, the folks down at Phoenix Science Foundation, are getting ready to launch an expedition to take a ship above the Arctic Circle, go through the Northwest Passage to an area that's never been seen by the ocean before, and try to get some measurements on just how high frequency this wobble might be.
Well, that's pretty significant evidence, then. I mean, it seems to me that if that is the case, that you have to almost accept that something major is going to happen within the next 5 or 10 years, correct?
I would say so. I mean, we were just discussing the solar cycle. Solar cycle 23 is coming to an end. Solar cycle 24 kind of started in February and then stopped, and we're kind of waiting for it to get started again. Because what happens to the polarity of the sun, its north and south poles, they flip at the solar maximum. which, you guessed it, is going to occur in 2012.
You know, there are some folks that are kind of saying on certain radio shows, all nothing's going to happen in 2012. It's going to be another Y2K, et cetera, et cetera. I take it you're probably not in that camp.
I think these are the same people that live within 20 miles of a coast and don't want to see their real estate values go down.
So we're starting to see a little bit of denial? People almost living in denial then?
Well, you know, we had this discussion the other night a couple of weeks ago, and it was, okay, Y2K had a lot of hype. Somebody said, gee, we forgot to put some binary code in, and when we have to put a 2 in there instead of a 1999, all the computers are going to stop. And so everything had to be Y2K compliant. Oh, my gosh, all these out-of-work accountants raked up like fat pigs. But there was no historical evidence for a Y2K. How many major civilizations have there been that have laid down record in stone, in gold, in clay, in paper, in records, in legends, that 2012 is going to be cataclysmic? I'm not sure I want to put my chips against all those civilizations. I think I'd rather take the warning.
Now, basically, if you live in the coastal areas, that's where you're under the highest risk, correct? I mean, there are certain safe areas, like probably Arizona. I've heard Ohio in that area is relatively safe. I've heard if you're near the Mississippi River, that's probably going to be flooded, and you don't want to be on the East Coast or the West Coast, or you don't want to be near Florida. But there are certain safe areas, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I would say areas like Montana, eastern Washington State, perhaps, you know, Kentucky, maybe not the lower parts of Tennessee, but certainly those areas do seem to be areas of safe haven. Now, I would personally not buy real estate and own or live in an area of one of three different categories. One, near an active or a dormant volcano. Two, I would not live near a coast because a 500-foot tsunami traveling at 400 or 500 miles an hour is not, you're not going to have much warning. You can only see about 8 or 9 miles out to sea, and I think that's about enough time to get the key in the ignition before it hits.
Wow.
And the other one, I would not live in the high or extremely low latitudes. I wouldn't live in Canada. I wouldn't live in southern Brazil. Because if we do have this global superstorm activity, which is quite possible, the ice age will come on very suddenly, and we're not talking about 3 or 4 feet of snow. We're talking about 3 or 4 meters of snow at a time. And we're not talking about 5 below or 10 below. We're talking 80 or 90 below zero. Most houses, most parkas, most automobiles are not made for that kind of cold weather. Not saying you couldn't survive, but you better have some food storage stored up or you're not going to survive.
Now, what I've done is we started our food storage. I've got a home generator. We're starting to make some preparations. Are you going to start talking about this on your show a little more often as we approach the 2012 date?
Well, we mention it from time to time, and we don't want to be the, you know, 2012, 24 hours a day, every day.
We
have a sponsor, an affiliate that we brought on about a year ago, NitroPack. I can't tell you how many food storage companies we went through until we found one that, you know, treated our customers right and would give us a commission for selling and those kinds of things. And NitroPack has just been awesome. They have everything from 72-hour kits to tents to solar blankets, water filters. As this war in Iraq begins to wind down, there are going to be metric tons of MREs available. It's just a fact when a conflict begins winding down, you could probably buy a case of MREs for $20.
Now, as we approach this gravity corridor, are we going to start to see cell phone outages, solar flares, maybe even internet outages?
As we get closer to, and a couple things are going to happen simultaneously, actually three things. One is that the solar flare activity, solar cycle 24, is going to get in full swing very soon. It is going to reach its maximum in 2012, but it's going to be coming up sharply in the next 12 to 16 months. That means that the solar flare activity is going to be very intense. An X-class, X9 flare is the most powerful flare that we can measure right now with the satellite that we have. The last time an X9 flare happened, it knocked out pagers, cell phones, GPS units. High-flying aircraft, high-latitude aircraft had to reroute the southern latitudes because for fear that the crew would experience too much radiation. This is the kind of event that we can see in the next 24 to 36 months. And yes, there are a lot more satellites up now than there were in the last solar cycle. A lot more, about three times as many. The French, the Japanese, the Chinese are launching satellites almost on a weekly basis from equatorial sites down in the French Guinea, or French New Guinea. That's the best place to launch satellites from. It costs the least amount of money. So, yes, a lot of effects will happen because of the solar activity.
Well, I ordered your book, and I'm also, I got the MP3s and the Windows media files, and I'm just starting to listen to those. So I'm going to try to educate myself as much as possible on this.
There's a lot.
It's overwhelming. The information is so dense. It's incredible. But I'll free up the line, and I appreciate you addressing my questions, and thanks for a great show.
No problem. Thanks, Mark. Tell a friend.
I will.
All right.
Bye-bye.
So Earth Explorers, we want to make sure that you have access to some of this information too. So there are a couple ways to do this, and I think the easiest way is for you to is to pick up the books. Now, as Mark was saying, I was interviewed on Coast to Coast with George Norrie on the 2nd of July, and the interview was successful to say the least, but we made a special offer on that program, and I want to extend that offer to our listeners tonight who may not have a Coast to Coast membership, Streamlink membership. Until August 2nd, that's a couple more weeks at the most, we are going to extend the same offer to X-Squared Radio listeners. If you go to arkofmillionsofyears.com, that's A-R-K, like Noah's Ark, and if you buy Volume 3, which just came out about 3 weeks ago, we will not only autograph the book and send it to you, you can get hardcover or softcover, and we have postage solutions there for U.S. and for Canadian, U.K. and European community folks, and also for Australian and New Zealand folks. You all have postage solutions there. If you buy the book from the website, we will send you an autographed copy, and we will send you a link so that you can download the audio version of Volumes 1 and 2. That's a $40 value added for nothing, for free, as a bonus from us. So if you're not a great reader, don't worry about it. I read it for you. But the files, we tried to get them as small as we could so that they'll fit on a CD. If you're not much of a CD burner, no problem. Put them on a MP3 device or an iPod and listen to them. Now, Volume 1 is not completely on MP3 yet. We're working on it. Right now it's in Windows Media Audio. So it's being changed as we speak. Should be up in 2 or 3 days. And then everything will be Mac and Windows compatible. And there are about 60 hours of listening there. You can catch up on the first two volumes while Volume 3 is being signed and shipped to you. And please give us a couple of weeks because we have to sign each one, package them, and for those that go to Canada, New Zealand, Europe, and parts beyond, we have to fill out customs slips on each one. So it takes a while for us to get that done. If you'll be patient, we can get all that out to you. And the reason we want you to have this information is because it is preparatory. These are now being called the end times books by thousands and thousands of readers, as well as the authors. We have painstakingly assembled all this information from every ancient civilization that left records and tied it together with modern physics and modern science and released a book that is basically non-biased. It's not trying to sell you on any particular religion or scientific viewpoint, but it will expose you to all of the ideas that are out there, the ideas to create awareness. It is to let your consciousness and your ability to envision and to manifest your own future to come out. Now, that being said, there are about 1,600 pages of reading and listening here. And anybody who goes through 2012, all the information that you can get your hands on, you're going to be pretty depressed. Because who wants to face a cataclysm? Unless you're a surfer and you want one last really wild ride. So we decided to divide Volume 3 into two parts. Part 1 and Part 2. Part 1 carries on just like the first two volumes, giving you lots of archaeological and lots of scientific information. There are over 189 pictures in this book. So if you like pictures, you're going to love this book. But it's very well written, it's very clear, and it lays down fact after fact after fact so that you can make your own mind up where you stand in relation to the origin and destiny of planet Earth and everything that lives on her. Part 2 does something that none of the other 2012 books do. We felt it was so necessary that rather than intersperse it through the book, paragraph by paragraph, we separated it out and made it a part 2 so that we could end the book not only on a positive note, but on a hopeful note, one that provides the reader with the ability to change things. What we realized a couple of years ago, there was a book that came out called The Secret. Rhonda Byrne wrote it and enjoyed an amazingly, phenomenally successful marketing plan. This book went everywhere. Of course, once it hit Oprah, it didn't take long. So, the point is that people became aware of the law of attraction. They knew that it worked. And let me tell you, dollar stores sold out of refrigerator magnets because people were putting stuff on their refrigerator door, everything that they wanted. They were buying lottery tickets, writing blank checks to themselves. I mean, I considered becoming a refrigerator magnate myself. Okay, I'm just giving you time to laugh. All right. The point is that it didn't work. People put pictures of things on their refrigerator. They hoped for lottery winnings. They wanted out of the poverty or the scarcity in which they lived, and nothing happened. Lots of people made lots of money off folks that were looking for that. So it's not that we felt bad, it's that we knew that there had to be some tools to be able to operate this law of attraction. What was it that made sports figures so successful? What was it that made investors successful? How did people find this resonance with their surroundings so that with very little effort they had huge successful windfalls? And they enjoyed their lives, and they were living their dream. How did this happen? Were they lucky? Well, that's what Part 2 is about. Part 2, very carefully, very simply, explains the mathematics behind resonance, behind the Fibonacci sequence, and lots of you have heard those terms bandied about and shaken about like talismans, like jewels or charms around the bracelet of a shaman. We break the code for you. We explain that carefully so that you can see how it works. If you've ever played the game of tetherball, you'll understand exactly what I'm talking about. You stand on the outside of a circle and you give the ball, which is attached to a rope, which is attached to a pole at the center of the circle. You give it a toss. It goes around the circle back to you. And if you swing too soon, the ball loses momentum and falls back toward the pole. If you swing too late, the same thing happens. You've got to keep your eye on the ball as it comes around and strike it at exactly the right moment. And then it doesn't take much energy at all. That ball picks up momentum and you win the game. Tesla did exactly the same thing with his resonance machines. He was able to make large bodies, steel beams, bridges, buildings, almost shake to the ground with infinitesimally small amounts of weight tapped at exactly the right moment. This is what the law of attraction is all about. We teach you how to work that resonance. We teach you how to listen for the high points that come around, know when to step, what door to go through, what window to go through and when, and how many times you have to do it before it begins moving. And when it begins moving, you'll sense it, and everyone around you will sense it. And if you can do it, you can teach someone else to do it. If 5 people can do it, it's great. If 5,000 people do it, it's better. 5 million people do it, the universe begins to change. And thus, the race of man might be able to walk away from the Armageddon that is planned for us by those of whom stand to make the most from it, I reckon. Those that are in the cataclysm in the Armageddon business. So, that brings us to the top of the first hour. And we routinely go past your imagination here at X Squared Radio. That's why we ask you to listen with your seatbelt on, but make sure that your chair is reclined and that you're looking out the window. And also, we want to let you know that although we are not recording the program tonight, X Squared Radio Studios, BBS Radio is recording the program tonight, and that will be available at bbsradio.com, and we'll provide a link to that from x2-radio.com, and we're also coming to you live via Steel Eye Media Network, courtesy of Kevin Smith. If you are familiar with the Kevin Smith Show, he's on nightly from 8 to 10 p.m. Central Time, and so that's Monday through Friday. It's KevinSmithShow.com. We have a link at our station. So I also want you to know the space shuttle fleet is very soon going to be retired. No other spacecraft in history has advanced the world more than this fleet. I wanted a way to keep that memory alive in my home, so I went to the space store and ordered a 25-inch model of the Space Orbiter. People who have seen it always comment on the incredible attention to detail in this model. And I think if you know someone who loves the space program and you want to get them a gift they will never forget, you should visit the Space Store at X Squared Radio. Just click on the banner and it'll take you directly there. They always have some great specials out there. Speaking of specials, one of the things we have learned from our many emails that we get is that there are many listeners to this program who are educators. Well, we have recently added a great affiliate for you, the Academic Superstore. It's a place where students and teachers can buy software, neat tools and gadgets, and even supplies, such as calculators and iPod peripherals, at amazing discounts, up to 70% off. All you have to do is click the Academic Superstore banner at X Squared Radio, and you too can start saving. Our friends down at NRG Resources, not to be confused with NRG Resources, the Canadian company, you know, that's traded on NASDAQ. We're talking about NRG Resources, the lubrication experts. They have a new product called TVT 24/7. Why is it called that? Well, interestingly enough, the inventor, Joe Listella, did years of research because he wanted to come up with a biodegradable, safe and stable lubricant that would outperform everything else on the market. And that he did. He compared it against the best. Slick 50, Duralube, Pennzoil, Quaker State, you name the lubricant, and they competed against it. Most of the lubricants failed the ASTM standardized test procedure in less than 10 minutes. That is to say, they started smoking and failed, and so would your engine. TVT 24/7 went 24 hours and still did not fail the test. You can get this amazing product for your vehicle, which will take any engine, transaxle, or other mechanism that runs iron gears or bearings against one another, and you can add it to it, 3% ratio. We sell a 12-ounce bottle at the online store at X Squared Radio. Get your bottle today. We stock these pretty regularly, but recently we just flash sold out. Now I got to tell you, there's over 500 million miles of performance testing on this lubricant in countries like China and Russia without a single engine failure. Not one. The deepest hole in the world is being drilled as we speak, and they're using TVT product as a thread lubricant to keep the drill pipe threads from seizing. Trust me, this is a good product. It works. I use it in my truck, and I've got over 180,000 miles on it. Well, have you ever thought about owning a telescope? I have. Oh, my gosh. If you've ever looked through a solar telescope at the sun, I'm sure you've seen photos of it. That's amazing enough. But when you look through a coronoscope, an H-alpha coronoscope at the sun, you are going to be amazed. Talk about a beautiful sight, everything in motion, just captivating. Well, at the Discovery Store, you can find the world's best telescopes, Mead 10-inch, 12-inch, 14-inch reflecting telescopes with motor drives, digital camera attachments, and let me tell you, all of the major comets and asteroids that have been discovered in the last 50 years, amateurs. All discovered by amateurs with their own telescopes. Not by the big governmental scopes. Those are all contracted many years out by universities and government grants. We're asking you, if you've ever thought about buying a telescope, get down to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio. Check out some of those telescopes. Start putting out one on layaway now for Christmas. Because once your kids start looking through one of these, their future course may be already be set. And who knows? You might just save the planet. So plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio. Now, most of you own inkjet printers. I do have a couple of them. I curse them on a regular basis. I'm just kidding. I used to buy my inkjet cartridges at a national chain store for about $30 per cartridge. Unbelievably expensive. The color and black cartridges together, they can run as much as $80 or more. Well, no more. I discovered a great place to buy printer supplies at 123 Inkjets. They not only provide excellent quality and fast shipping, sometimes it's free. Every time I buy, I get a chance to win a free printer. Now, how cool is that? So stop paying the high prices. Visit 123 Inkjets at X Squared Radio today and start saving money. And that's the way to go. Also help you with recycling those old cartridges if you want to. Now, in this hour, this is the second hour of X Squared Radio. If you are not getting all 3 hours, be sure to let us know at bagnew at x2-radio.com or get a hold of our producers down at BBS Radio and let them know, because we will make sure that your affiliate covered carries all 3 hours. You know, a strange thing is happening to free internet radio, free press out there. It used to be that you could get on the radio and you could discuss politics of the day, you could discuss modern science, breakthroughs, even religion. But those days are quickly coming to an end as larger and larger conglomerates form and buy each other out and consume all of the once independent radio stations around the country and start carrying single programming over hundreds and hundreds of radio stations. You can literally drive from one end of the country to the other without missing more than a few minutes of your favorite AM radio program. Well, those days are coming to an end. The reason is because people are no longer interested in the programming that they're offering. Because it's canned. Because it's guided. Because it has an agenda. Not so with internet radio. And it's not so hard to become a host. If you want to become one, contact the studios at bbsradio.com and find out if you have what it takes. That being said, there are about 1,000 new internet radio programs coming on the line and about 1,000 going out of business. It takes a lot each week, each day, sometimes, to get on the radio and speak to millions of people and have something to say that people want to hear. Sometimes you run out of things to say. Not around here, but oftentimes people do. And it takes time to prepare the programs. It takes time to keep them interesting, assemble your sponsors, come up with a theme and an idea behind your radio program. If you think you have what it takes, get a hold of the folks at BBS Radio. See if you have a career inside of you. Now that being said, internet radio is a little bit different than AM radio in the sense that our listeners don't have a steering wheel in their hands. They're not careening down the highway at 80 miles an hour trying to write a web address down or a phone number to partake in a special offer. Oh no. Our listeners are sitting there with a PC and a credit card. That makes them uniquely suited to buy your product. If you have something that you think someone would want to buy with a credit card or a PayPal account and a PC, then you need to be advertising on X Squared Radio, or on another host show here at BBS Radio. Believe me, every single one of us out here is looking for a sponsor somewhere, $50 here, $100 there. You're not going to reach the people in your local neighborhood. You're going to reach people in the global neighborhood. You will have customers in New Zealand, in Vancouver, in California, in Florida, New York, and Arizona, all at the same time. And whereas the AM station is going to charge you about $1.50, anywhere from 50 cents to $1.50 per 1,000 listeners, which is verified by various listing media, internet radio is substantially cheaper. And you can even set up what's called click for sale. That means you don't have to pay for the advertising until somebody comes to your store and buys something. That's how high-tech this industry has gotten. So if you're sitting out there with a local business, you're doing embroidery or business cards, or you're selling cell phone covers or publishing services, and you want to reach more people, the smart thing to do is to advertise on internet radio. That's all the commercials we can do for this hour. On this program, we do all of our advertising at the top of the hour. We talk about the good stuff in between. So, that being said, let's get back to it. I want to talk to you a little bit about Tesla Tech. No, this is not an infomercial. TeslaTech.info, the convention's coming up. It starts July 31st and goes to August 3rd. It is at the Albuquerque... Hang on, just one moment. Let me pull it up real quick. At TeslaTech.info, it's taking place at the University of New Mexico and Albuquerque, New Mexico. And it's easy to find, very close to the airport. And we're all staying at the Clubhouse Inn and Suites in Albuquerque 4 days, and you're going to see some of the best new technology, energy technology, in the world today. Brand new stuff. From the garages, the attics, and the backyard laboratories of America. Some of this is not going to come from corporate America. No, I doubt you're going to see too many Exxon displays, but you are going to find out about something like magnetic motors, zero-point energy-saving devices, cosmic radiant energy, low-temperature plasma, electrogravitation, electromedicine, and even magnetic healing. These are just some of the areas that will be available there, or that will be covered there, and I'll be speaking the first night there on Hollow Earth Theory. So lots to go on at teslatech.info. Earlier we were talking about weather anomalies, and of course the weather has settled back down to very predictable patterns and nothing very exciting in it at all. No, I'm just kidding. Absolutely not. The weather has been doing things in every corner of the world that are not ordinary and have little historical backing to it. For one thing, the Antarctic, that's the one at the South Pole, is getting larger and colder. It snowed in Johannesburg, for crying out loud. It snowed in Sydney, Australia. Brazil, Argentina, Peru, they've been getting hammered with heavy winters. Likewise, up here in the state of Washington, where we're coming to you from, in the eastern desert, they had the longest, coldest winter in history. And now, we're having one of the driest summers ever. Normally, this is the breadbasket of the world, providing wheat. This year, harvests in some areas are down 80%. In other areas, they're just fine. But dryland wheat hasn't done so well this year. Why is the weather changing? Why is the weather everywhere out of the ordinary? Is it El Niño, La Niña? Is it sunspots, solar flares? You know what? They've tried every theory possible, and none of it holds water. Is it SUVs? Is it greenhouse gases? Well, certainly that exacerbates the problem. And yes, it is possible to reverse those effects or slow them down if we just lower our carbon output a little bit, if we just stop burning petroleum for fuel and find other things like alcohol or biodiesel to run in our vehicles. It was once done very economically. I'm sitting in a biodiesel plant right now in eastern Washington state that's perfectly capable of supplying about 7% of the biodiesel, the diesel fuel needed for the state of Washington. And it'll do even more than that. Another 30 or 40 plants like this in the United States, and we could make a significant dent in the capacity we need for refineries to produce more petroleum products in this country. This radio host's opinion still stands on how ludicrous it is that here we are in the 21st century, able to travel to other planets on a routine basis, and we are still shoveling our planet into our gas tanks and burning it. How ridiculous is that? Well, somebody's laughing all the way to the bank now, aren't they? Well, there are alternatives out there. Why aren't these alternatives in your backyard? Why can't you go down the street and find biodiesel for the same price or even cheaper than you can regular rack petroleum diesel? Well, the answer is simple. It's so simple, it's amazing. It's access to capital. You see, the oil companies are not going to put up the money to supply alternative fuels to you. No, no. They already have a fuel. They pump it out of the ground. About 60% of it domestically and about 40% to 50% of it from foreign sources. Of course, the foreign sources are now charging close to $150 a barrel, even though the cost of local drilled oil hasn't changed in 25 years. Who's realizing the profits on the 40 to 50% that's being drilled domestically? you guessed it, the same oil companies that won't give you those alternative fuels. So what's it going to take? Well, I guess the federal government's going to have to step in and start subsidizing these businesses so that they can get their technology up and running, so that you can have a clean-burning fuel for your car. I'm waiting. Are you waiting? There you go. The only way this is going to happen is if the consumer takes it upon themselves to find an alternative energy provider and begin sending them, in effect, some tax money. Oh, my goodness, I use that word. I don't mean somebody coming into your home and your financial statement and saying, gee, I think you can do without another 1% of your income. We're going to take it from you and give it to them. No, I'm asking for a volunteer. In fact, I'm asking for 1 million volunteers. 1 million volunteers with 10 bucks a month. Find an energy provider, an alternative energy provider that you like. Solar power, wind power, algae for biodiesel, cellulosic ethanol, some form of alternative fuel, and start sending them $10 a month. Call it a tax. Call it an energy investment. It's going to cost you nothing. That $120 a year, you're going to spill at the movie theater. You might as well give it to something that's going to give a return. There are thousands and thousands of inventors out there who are looking for capital to get their prototypes ready for manufacturing. There are at least a dozen manufacturing plants out there that are waiting for energy devices, generation devices, and conservation devices to manufacture, and they aren't getting them because the inventors, the providers of the technology, can't afford to put them into manufacturing. Now, Carl Sagan once classified civilizations as 0, 1, 2, or 3. A zero civilization... and they are extinct. A class one society has learned to master the energy systems in their planet. They live in harmony with it. They don't take any more from it than it can provide, and they give back to it in equal portion. A class two society has learned to live with the power inside its own solar system, inside its own region of the galaxy. And a class three society has learned to live within the energy system of a galaxy. I shudder to think how much power is available in our galaxy. One star is at the center of our galaxy and has enough energy to hold all the millions and millions of stars and planets and asteroids and moons in its orbit. Now that is a lot of energy. And guess what? That's only the matter and energy that we can see with our eyes. And it only makes up 5% of the universe. 94 to 95% of the universe is invisible to our eyes, and yet it provides tremendous amounts of energy all around us. Well, there are smart people out there who are trading, gathering, and building information and inventions to tap into that information, tap into that energy, and move us from a class zero society to a class one. Now, I effectively could make the argument that we're probably at a 0.75 right now, because I'm looking out at 28,000 square feet outside my office window that's full of equipment that turns sunlight directly into biodiesel. At about a 3-to-1 ratio. That is to say, we get 3 times more energy out of the system than we put in. That's a nice return on investment. That can be done everywhere. It can be done in your backyard. And you could be running your diesel truck or your diesel farm machinery or your diesel generator on a fuel that doesn't pollute. It's not a hazardous material, and it comes straight from the sun. We didn't have to drill any holes for it, and we didn't have to fight any wars for it. Now, is that worth $10 a month? I'm not asking you to invest in anything particular. I haven't mentioned a single company name. I want you to hit the internet, do some research, and find a company. And start today, because we don't have much time. So that being said, how and why are these weather patterns the way they are? Excuse me while I change my body chemistry a little bit with some water. Okay, we were talking earlier about global superstorms. And by the way, I want to remind you, if you're sitting out there listening, that's all well and good, but we love to hear from you. Because tonight, you are the experts on X Squared Radio. So the phone lines are open. We want you to give us a call. Phone lines are open. Just go to x2-radio.com or bbsradio.com. The phone numbers are right on the cover, front page, and they're open right now, and we'll take your calls. So what is a global superstorm? You may have read the book, Coming Global Superstorm, by Art Bell and Whitley Strieber. You may have done some internet research. You may have seen the movie The Day After Tomorrow. That's a little bit like how a global superstorm will happen. As you know, global warming is happening. And as I said earlier, maybe the activities of mankind are exacerbating it, but something else is causing it. How do we know this? Because all the planets in the solar system are warming as well. Jupiter and Saturn and Venus, Uranus, guess what? We've monitored their temperatures, and they're coming up at the same ratio that ours is. The atmospheric pressure of Saturn has changed 30% in the last 19 years. Talk about a cataclysm. Well, what's making it rise? We're not really sure. Can we survive? We're not really sure. But we have some history. We know other civilizations have survived, and what it takes is preparedness. But what are we going to watch for? What is a global superstorm? Well, if you watch the evening weather coming this winter, you'll begin to see the patterns of what I'm talking about. A superstorm in the northern hemisphere is a storm that rotates in counterclockwise motion, a lot like a hurricane does, usually 300 to 500 miles in diameter, maybe a little bit bigger, about 1,000 miles in diameter. Fairly high winds, 40 to 60 miles an hour. Doesn't have to be 120 or 140 mile an hour winds. These would be considered a tropical storm if they were down by the equator. But these are high latitude. These are high latitude storms. These are ones that are brought in by the jet stream up around the northeast or northwest of the continents. They rotate in counterclockwise position. In rotation. And what they do is they pick up Arctic air, super cold air, from high altitudes. Now, if you've ever flown in a jetliner at 8 miles up, which is about 40,000 feet, you know what the temperature is, don't you? Even in the summertime, it's 60 below zero outside. In the wintertime, it can get even colder than that, 75 below zero. That's what it is on the outside of that airplane. Now, that being said, that allows for a little bit of air density, enough so to move under the wings, causing the Bernoulli effect to function and the lift of that aircraft to work, thus getting a million-pound airplane up into the air where it just shouldn't be. That being said, now you've got this counterclockwise 500 to 1,000-mile diameter storm. And it's pulling high-altitude Arctic air down into it, like a drain, like a funnel. And what happens is this super cold air begins to hit moisture that's pulled up off the ocean. And it doesn't form snow. It forms an ice crystal. And this is a super cold ice. And that ice comes pounding down into the surface of the Earth at between 40 and 70 miles an hour. It piles up at the rate of about 3 to 4 meters every 24 hours. in about 2 days, you've got so much snow and ice packed into areas that are normally used to seeing, what, 3 feet, 4 feet at the most of snow. And this isn't wet snow. This is dry snow. This is really cold snow with really cold air behind it. And what happens is it covers such a broad geographical region with this white snow that when the sun comes out, it doesn't melt because it's all reflecting the energy back out into space. The albedo of the Earth begins to climb. That means more and more energy is reflected back out into space. And that summer, the snow doesn't melt all the way. And then winter comes again and again. And now you have something that's called an ice age. Ice ages do not come on very slowly. We're not talking about a glacier proceeding at the rate of 3 feet for every 10 years, and you have enough time to grow old and die before it gets to your neighborhood. This is amount of snow and ice that piles down on top of your neighborhood in a matter of days. 1 or 2 days. Now, I don't need to tell you what would happen to New York City if 12 feet of super cold snow fell upon it with winds 60 and 70 miles an hour and temperatures at 60 below zero. Every water pipe in the entire city would burst. And I don't need to tell you what happens to people living in a high rise with no food or water. 12.5 million of them. They get hungry and they want to move. That causes stress on other city systems. Same thing with Chicago. Same thing with Minnesota. Same thing as far south as St. Louis, Kansas City, Omaha, Denver. You get the picture? So I'm telling you, high latitude places might not be the place to be in. Close to shorelines might not be the place to be either. Use your head. Find a place that's compatible. And start preparing. Because it's now 2008. And 2012 is just around the corner. One of the things that precipitates ice ages is high latitude clouds. High altitude clouds. High-altitude clouds block the solar radiation way up high, where the reflection or the energy absorbed by the clouds isn't transferred to the ground. It doesn't act as an insulator. It acts as a reflector. What causes high-altitude clouds? Two things. One is volcanic debris blown up into the stratosphere. Volcanic debris. It's happened in the past. In the early 19th century, we experienced the same thing. All it would take is 2 or 3 major volcanic events, and you've got high-altitude particulate matter blown up into the stratosphere, taking a couple of years to drop out of the way, and you've got a sun shield. The other thing that causes high-altitude clouds is cosmic radiation. Where does cosmic radiation come from? It comes from solar flares. Well, gee, no solar flares right now because we have no sunspots. We're at a solar minimum. True enough. But solar cycle 24 has begun, and guess when the solar maximum is? You guessed it. 2012. More solar flare activity means high-altitude cloud activity. That, coupled with a volcanic event or two, which would be precipitated by a rapid change in gravitational field, which will also take place in 2012, and that coupled with counterclockwise northern hemisphere rotating large storms in the high latitudes, like we've been seeing for the last couple years in the northwest and the northeast. In 1999, we saw 75% of a global superstorm hit the northeast. All it lacked was about a 40 degrees of the pie shape of that storm to be complete. Had it completed that last little pie piece of that storm, you would have had classic conditions stretching from Chicago all the way past Bangor, Maine. That's a large region of the country under snow. Last winter, I flew from Kentucky, actually Indiana, all the way to California, the entire way. Every mile of the way, the ground was white. When that ground is white, that means the energy is reflecting back out into space. It's just one piece in the cycle. More is coming. Well, what do we do? How do we get prepared? What do we watch for? Well, I'll tell you what you don't watch for. Don't watch for those programs that are saying why this isn't going to be any more calamitous than Y2K was. It's going to be a blip on the radar screen. Come on down and buy your SUV. Put your money into a CD. And let's go on vacation for a while. Don't go there. We have work to do. These weather anomalies will increase. We will keep you informed of them here at X Squared Radio. And we'll let you know when something's coming. Excuse me while I hit the cough button. Again, let me remind you that our phone lines are open. All phone lines are open. We'll take your calls. Anytime you want to reach us, we're here. I know that weather's extraordinary outside, and it is vacation month. A lot of people are out there enjoying themselves. Our phone number is toll-free in the U.S., 888-228-4494. In Canada, we have a toll-free number for you. Lots of people bought the Ark of Millions of Years last year from Canada. My goodness. Phone number is 877-489-6350 for you in Canada, toll free. And anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you want to reach us, you can do so by getting to a cell phone tower, 530-776-5154 or 530-776-5154. 5185. We'd like you to keep up with stuff too and make sure to get to our friends down there at UFO Magazine. The link is at X Squared Radio on the front. We do not get a commission or anything for subscribing to UFO Magazine, but the editor's great and the work they do with their independent magazine is just astounding in this genre. Lots of informative articles from lots of great writers. So it's not very expensive. Sign up for a hard copy of the UFO Magazine. Click on that banner at X Squared Radio. And we also want to let you know a little bit about the expedition. Next half hour, we're going to talk about the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition. And in our final hour, we're going to talk about coincidence and manifestation. Some people have been asking us about this lately. I've got some really interesting stories to share with you. And perhaps we can get something cranked up in the last hour. We have an experiment we'd like to try with all of you out there. And if you're listening live tonight, Sunday evening, July 20th, we want you to give us a call down here, and we'll talk about it. The North Pole Inner Earth Expedition back in 2005 was organized by Stephen Curry, Rodney Clough, and several others that were very interested in finding out if the Earth was hollow. And I know lots of people are interested in this, but it's all about approach. It's all about process and how you figure things like this out. First, it was thought, well, gee, we'll just charter an airplane and we'll fly over it. Well, the problem is that there aren't many pilots out there like Admiral Byrd anymore. And you'll remember Admiral Byrd was on a military mission in this exploration, and he flew across the North Pole at an altitude of 2,500 feet. We can't find anybody to fly at that altitude these days. And there are no bases up on the Arctic Circle, as there were then, that fuel up an aircraft. That means we have to take a plane with enough range, which in the charter price range is a 727. The lowest that they will fly a 727 is 16,000 feet. All we're going to see from that altitude, folks, is clouds. clouds and more clouds. Not what we wanted to see. We'll cover this a little more in a minute. We have a caller on the line. Your first name and where you're calling from, please.
Well, this is Kayla from Tennessee in the Smoky Mountains.
Hi, Kayla. Welcome
How are you
to
doing?
The program.
Pardon?
I said, welcome to the program.
Yes. I guess what I wanted to call and talk to you about, because, there just seems to be so many things out here, and then you read things about this person and that person, this disinformation, and you really just don't know where to go anymore. I mean, I rely on what I see Mother Earth doing right now, but Webfrey on his show last night, and he was up there at Mount Baker, and they're all saying that because, you know, Dan Burrish and the Looking Glass technology and all that through MJ-12, and anyway, the timelines have changed now. We're not headed towards that, you know, extinction-level event and the cataclysmic events to happen on Earth, that we're now approaching a time by 2012 where we're going to reach that golden age. I still see myself personally, Brooks, I see a lot of changes that need to take place. They're not to be feared if you move out of Earth's way, you know, best you can. Maybe there are things that have to happen, I think.
What kind of changes would you think need to be made?
Well, the Earth has to do some cleaning, house cleaning, which he's already been doing. That's what flooding and stuff is about. Climates are changing. You know, if you're going to have as the biblical aspect of this says, heaven on earth, well, you look around right now, it ain't looking too much like heaven, is it?
Yeah, I see your point. I see your point. So what is it that mankind can do to help Earth reset itself?
By understanding and helping, not only in the physical aspect, doing our part as far as recycling, and like you were talking earlier in the show, of really trying to push, to force the government's hand, I guess, and because we're the consumer and we way outnumber government. And all these large corporations, if we simply stop purchasing from them and say we want something better and we know it's out there, well, you hit them in their pocketbooks. You know, you don't put together rallies and you go, you know, march on Washington, D.C., talk. That's all they do. It will accomplish nothing. You have to hit them in their pocketbooks.
You know, there's an organization out there called the Alliance for Climate Change.
Really?
They had a newspaper article recently, it was about a month and a half ago, said they're going to raise and spend $100 million a year for the next 3 years. $300 million on global warming awareness. So I wrote him. I said, yeah, this is a really great idea, global warming awareness. How wonderful. We have two companies out here that have products that will reverse global warming. One of them is a biodiesel plant. A biodiesel company that has recently built a plant, and as you know, biodiesel is non-polluting, non-hazardous, and will free up gobs of capacity in our refineries and prevent us from having to drill anymore. What a great stride forward this would be in global warming. Can you help us with any grants? You're raising $100 million a year. They wrote back and said, absolutely not. We do not contribute to such efforts. The only thing we're about is awareness and supporting political candidates that believe the way we do.
Oh,
well,
there
you go.
There's
the truth of the matter.
Yeah,
now,
there we
earlier you said forcing the government's hand. I go to Washington from time to time, Washington, D.C., and one of the things that I noticed, just from a casual scientific point of view, of course, is that we don't really have a government. We have a loose coalition of bureaucracies who are living off taxpayers.
Well, President Eisenhower, when in his farewell speech, pretty much said it the way it was. And unfortunately, we did not heed those very wise words of wisdom that day when he left office. And then he said, beware of the industrial military corporate complex. And this is where we're at today.
Yep.
We've been lulled
asleep. Like you said, we vastly outnumber them.
Absolutely.
But I don't think we're ever going to force government's hand. However, I do like the idea of hitting them in the pocketbook, but I'd rather do it positively than negatively.
Right.
Some guy came up with a great idea a few years ago called the alphabetical boycott. He said, don't change the way you buy gas. Don't change your driving habits at all. Let's just boycott all the oil companies that start with the letter A this month. And next month we'll go to the ones that start with B, and the next one C. And what you're doing is you're taking 1/12 of their income and removing it.
Uh-huh.
He said, by the time you get to the C's, they're going to change the price of oil.
They got the message. Yeah, they would get the message.
I don't think it would
work.
I
like that idea, too.
I don't think it would work. I think what would work is you positively use your money instead of negatively use your money. Find an alternative fuel that worked for you and buy it. And don't change your lifestyle very much at all. Just move the income stream away from what you don't want and toward what you do want.
Well, yeah, Brooks, you know, here's what my hope is, and I share this thought with many others at this point, because, you know, the gas pumps are strangling most Americans today. We're just hanging on by fingernails, you know. And what we're hoping is that their greed will do them in, because right now, the story about that there's the oil does not replenish itself and we're running out, I just quite frankly can't buy that. But what I'm hoping is that there's a lot of creative, inventive things going on right now, and as the old cliche goes, once the cat's out of the bag, you can't get it back in. And I think that the big, huge oil conglomerates are going to go the way of the dinosaurs, because the cat is getting out of the bag as we speak. And people are looking. In fact, it was on the news today on one of the Spanish stations. They were showing the new electric cars, and they will all be out by 2010, I believe. And they're going to reduce the prices so it's affordable for all to buy. And you just plug it into a 110 outlet, and you can drive around all day. You plug it in at night when you come in the house.
But that technology has been out for 10 years.
Of course it has, but there's been nobody to push it.
Well, we were producing Ford Geos years ago with electric motors run on batteries. And
Well, you know, my uncle was in the military, and one of his
people love him.
Pardon?
Oh, I said the people love him. They love a car you can plug into the wall.
Oh, yeah. But he was telling me that even back in the 1950s, they had a carburetor, and they used it on the bases, the military bases and stuff, but this carburetor got 155 miles to the gallon.
Well, I've never seen that one. I saw the one that got 50 miles per gallon, but that thing had no power at all. I mean, it had maybe 40 horsepower, and it should have had 150.
Huh.
It had no power at all, just little teeny tiny jets in it, and it was a forward-mounting carburetor. Never seen anything get 155 miles per gallon that had 40 horsepower.
I didn't ask him what the horsepower or anything was, but they had developed a carburetor that got that kind of mileage. I don't know if it was a little putt-putt to run around the field and stuff there.
I think it wouldn't be safe enough for today's freeways.
No.
It wouldn't be. Now, my truck gets between 23 and 25 miles per gallon, and it's a three-quarter ton diesel pickup. It runs on biodiesel.
Huh.
And that's not bad. I mean, it'll tow a fifth wheel uphill in a hurricane.
I want to ask a question. Can you put, I know Willie Nelson, I was really pushing for this, like the cooking oil, you know, you'd go around and collect it from McDonald's, restaurants, whatever, you know, the fry oil. Can you run that in your car?
In a sense, you can. Not in a gasoline car. In a diesel engine, you can run it. But first, you have to do...
In a diesel, okay.
Right. It's
what
diesel,
would it do to a gasoline one?
Well, gasoline will run effectively off ethanol. So you could completely eliminate gasoline and just run your car completely off ethanol. You'd have a hard time keeping it
dry. Where do you find it?
Well, you make it. Now, in Kentucky, they sell what's called E85, with 85% ethanol, and most cars run pretty well on it. But you can make your own ethanol with, you know, yard clippings. It's not that hard to do, cellulosic ethanol.
Really?
Yeah. Making a still, you know, cars used to run on alcohol back in the 20s, and what happened was Rockefeller
what kind of alcohol?
And his ethanol, same ethanol that
you
drink.
Oh, okay.
What Rockefeller did is he decided that he wanted cars to run on gasoline, so they implemented prohibition, which shut down all the stills. Nobody made alcohol. Vehicles didn't run on gasoline. It was too dangerous. Ethanol was the fuel of choice.
Oh,
and
you
go to any racetrack you want in the country. Nobody runs gasoline. They all run methanol.
Really?
Yeah.
I never
all
knew
that. All the NHRA, NASCAR, all that, all those cars run off methanol. They don't run on gasoline. That's crazy.
Yeah, because that's a higher burn. Yeah.
Well, it has the same amount of BTU in it, and you have to rejet your vehicle and make some other changes. But the fact is that it's far cheaper to run on that than it is gasoline, and you don't have to drill for it.
Oh, interesting. Very interesting.
Any gasoline engine out there, injected or otherwise, will run on straight ethanol. Some minor changes to timing and jet sizes, and you're good to go.
Really? And you can make your own.
Sure.
Hmm.
And you could.
How long does the process take?
Well, it's pretty quick. It depends on how big your still is, but something about the size of a garbage can, a couple of garbage cans put together, or a couple 55-gallon drums put together, can make enough ethanol to run a vehicle on.
Hmm. And do you make it the same way that the old moonshiners make their moonshine?
You got it. Of course, today if you make ethanol, you're going to have to put benzene in it, or they're going to come get you, because you can't make ethanol without a license, and you got to have that little tax stamp. And we don't want you sampling your gasoline either in the backyard with the, you know, your barbecue.
Might not, because then they get you.
Well, listen, let me catch some more callers. And
I really
appreciate the call, and put us on your favorites list and come back.
To you. I try to listen every Sunday.
Wonderful. Oh, thank you so much.
I really, Brooks, want to say I really enjoyed that person or being who came on the last hour of the show from the Earth Center.
Oh, you're
you
talking
know?
About Billy. Yeah, Colonel Billy. That was interesting, wasn't it?
Wasn't it? Yes. I would love to hear you guys converse again sometime.
You never know. That just might happen. Just might happen.
Yeah.
You have yourself a great week.
You too, dear. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, we have another caller on the line. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from, please.
This is Lyle from Indianapolis, Indiana.
Hi, Lyle. Welcome to the program.
How are you doing, Dr. Agnew?
I'm doing wonderful up here in the wasteland of eastern Washington State.
I wanted to say, before I start, I wanted to say thank you for putting the, I have both volumes of the Ark of Millions of Years, and I got the MP3s on the first Ark of a Million of Years. And I say, and that really touched me. There was something that I, when you were reading that, there was something that touched my soul that made me think that, you know, what you were saying was true and correct. And I can't explain it. I was on my way to Ohio, and I was listening to it, and I can't tell you, you know, how it made me feel and the truth of it, and kind of a longing for something that, you know, that we're missing.
Yeah,
so
I know
thank
exactly
you
what
for
you mean.
Putting that on MP3 for me to listen to.
Well, I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. When my co-author and I had published that book, the first book, The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 1, we really didn't know how it would go. And you know, although she didn't take as much of a professional risk as I did, because I was a commercial scientist and she was an archaeologist, so it was kind of down her alley, but certainly not mine. We kind of wondered how it would go. You know, would it sell? Would people, you know, pick up on the idea? Would it resonate with anyone? And gosh, within 3 or 4 months, you know, it was a national bestseller. Now it's tailed off significantly since then. And in doing so, I said, well, gee, how can I get the book in more people's hands? So I sat down chapter by chapter and I read the book. That took 30 hours to do. And I can't tell you how rewarding that was for me to sit down there and read that book into a microphone and imagine people, you know, just like you, Lyle, listening to the book on CD or on their MP3 player. What are they going to get out of this book? And I can't tell you how much your words mean to me. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for providing it. My question was, were you going to do it for Volume 3 also?
Well, the answer is yes. Right now, Volume 3 has only been out for about 3 weeks. We were very pleased that it made in the top 69 books on Amazon, in the top 100 on Barnes & Noble, which is pretty darn good for an independent author not coming to a major publisher and doing your own promotion, and a really terrible job at your own web mastering. But we definitely are going to record the book. Right now I'm a little busy with my 6 full-time jobs, which center around this biodiesel plant, but we're getting ready to wrap this one up. This plant's going to start up at just a skunch over 8 million gallons a year in about 4 weeks, and then I'll have a little breathing room, and I'll sit down in front of the microphone and record that book.
Well, thank you in advance. Like I said, I really enjoyed it. And I wanted to talk about the global warming thing.
Okay.
You know, there's a natural, it's a natural process. But what our politicians and you hear all these companies talk about, even the company that I work for, is talking about going green. You know, the reason why they're pushing this global warming thing is for the Western world, they want to basically charge a tax on people. And, you know, they've said how bad it is for you to have more than one kid. That's just a way for them to do what China is doing over there with their one-child policy. But they knew it wasn't going to come over here and fly. So they said, well, we'll use the global warming thing, and we'll do a CO2 tax. Look, CO2 is a good gas. That's what the plants use to, along with sunlight, to convert to oxygen. And I've seen somewhere where basically right now the Earth is in a CO2 starved condition. I mean, it's at one of its lowest points. So, you know, CO2 is good. It's good for the plants. It's good for the planet.
Well, you know, a lot of people say, oh, stop cutting down the rainforests, because if you do, you know, we're going to lose all the oxygen of the earth. The fact is that the rainforest is a very old, old forest. It's many, many, many thousands of years old, and it doesn't put off oxygen. It puts off CO2. Old trees do not put off oxygen. They put off CO2. All the oxygen on earth comes from the same place it has always come from, algae.
Right.
So when we talk about, say, algae for biodiesel, we're talking about concentrating the populations of algae in engineered pond systems, harvesting the algae, separating the algae from their oil, degumming the oil, and turning that into diesel fuel, taking the remaining algae bodies and doing one of two things with it, one of three things with it. A, fertilizer. B, high-protein meal for both animals and humans. And C, fuel for bacteria to turn the algae into alcohol, ethanol. The CO2 from the bacteria feeds the algae, and the oxygen from the algae feed the bacteria. So you have a symbiotic relationship, a plant set up, if you will, that runs two different media back and forth, feeding one another. One generates alcohol for the esterification process, the other runs the oil for the biodiesel process, and both of them produce high-protein meals. Now that's pretty neat engineering, and you don't have to drill any holes, and you don't have to fight any wars for it. That technology's here today.
One of the other things is, you know, we don't really, I don't think we need any fuels. The zero point energy, that it seems like in the past they were more in tune with it, if I could say that. Basically, there were things that the, people were using called earth batteries, and they used using no fuel. I think they used copper and zinc, and they were able to get electricity from the ground, which really means that electricity is really not generated the way that we think it's generated. It may be a force that the motors, you know, when they turn, they're actually creating a channel for, to come down the line, but the motors are not the actual things that are generating the electricity.
Right, yeah, exactly right. We visited a site in Egypt called the Osirian, and it looks like this facility, at least from the photographs and things that we've been able to review, was just that. It was sort of an earth battery, and it might have generated as much as 4 million volts DC.
Yes, I was going to say that I had read, I know Edgar Cayce and another author whose name escapes me, but basically they were saying that the pyramids were used for both communication. That's why you see them around the world in different countries, and it formed a grid, basically, to allow communications. The pyramids were also used spiritual growth and the ability to transport to other worlds, basically.
Yeah, I think that's not only... that there does seem to be some record of that, especially if you go to Tibet. You can see that, at least in an artistic fashion, they recorded that very thing, opening up stargates, as it were, access points to other points in the universe or even other dimensions.
Right. Right. And the more that I hear it, you know, I first heard people say that history is not what you think it is. It's written by the victors. And I believe that's more true, and our history has been written to provide us with a certain view of things, so that certain people can stay in power.
Well, it's that power over us. That's a very astute point. That's a very astute point. That, and you can look at it over the decades, even inside our country. In the early 20th century, for instance, history books were pretty much the opinion of whatever textbook company was making textbooks. And by the mid-20th century, 1950s, 1960s, The competition between textbook companies was pretty open. McGraw-Hill, Simon & Schuster, you know, all these textbook companies. And education had always been kind of competitive, even between school districts. School districts had complete autonomy as to what textbooks they would use to teach their students, right?
Right.
So what happened is education began federalizing, and the federal government began stepping in and asked the states to put together standardized exams, and now all 50 states have their own standardized exams. All the teachers in each of the 50 states teach one thing. They teach the exam, because those schools are rewarded on how well the students do on that state exam, right? But
right.
Still, you had 50 different viewpoints on which textbook was the best for their state. Now you have the federal government stepping in and putting federal standards in on education, and now the competition between textbook companies has been eliminated, because the teachers are still teaching the test, but now there's only one version to match, and that's the federal version. And so all the textbooks are coming in line with the federal government's viewpoint of what history is.
Right. And there's a book out there called The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America, and it's by Charlotte Irsby. And it's a pretty big book. It's the size of a phone book. But she goes through it and tells that the government basically wants to dumb down the kids, and there's a reason for that. If you look in history, usually while things go along, the upper echelon of society usually gets stuck in a position. They start taking and abusing the middle class and the lower class. Well, usually what happens, the middle class usually causes causes a reversal of that, and they begin to rise up to the upper echelon through the changes that they've caused, whether it be revolution, et cetera, et cetera. And this is this dumbing down of America is a way for, they believe, a way for them to control that so that the middle class doesn't rise up and take the place of, the upper echelons that are here now.
Uh-huh.
The ones that are there now are trying to use science to basically figure out how we think and control us by that. But, I don't think that's going to succeed, because they're missing a key element, and that's the spiritual element that they can't measure, no science can measure. And I want go ahead.
I think science can measure it, and actually we're going to spend some time on this in the third hour. We're definitely going to talk about human consciousness and whether it's coincidence or manifestation. It can be measured, and believe it or not, the very successful in life, either through coincidence or manifestation, have figured out how to work the system. And you're right. Each time it looks like the middle class is beginning to, or the lower class is climbing up into the middle class, and the middle class is beginning to become the upper class will have an event which will be like Control-Alt-Delete. It resets everything and eliminates the middle class. Now, some of the middle class capitalizes on it and moves up, but most of it moves right back down the ladder to the lower class.
But I think we're in a period where that's not going to work this time. And it's just a feeling that I have. I think we're basically at the end of a road, whether you want to say it's, there's, like the mind said, we're getting ready to change the consciousness, going to another consciousness, but I don't think the old ways are working anymore. And I'm sorry, the spiritual element can be measured, but it cannot be controlled, I don't think.
Uh-huh.
I think it's harder to control. And actually, I think that and this is again from readings that I had, things that I've read, I believe that the, you know, we are trying to capture in science which we were able to do spiritually.
Mm-hmm.
With, you know, we have the ability to do, and that's what I think, and I'll give you an explanation. When they talk about the Tower of Babel, I believe at some point in time that we were a telepathic race, and that the Tower of Babel indicates the time that we've lost that ability to communicate telepathically. And I think with this change that's coming, that we may be able to, we're going to get that ability back, and it's because of something that I read in the Bible that kind of made the connection for me, where they talk about there will be no secret that will be held, that will be concealed.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that points to, you know, the telepathic ability, and I could be in, I might be wrong on that, but that's what I believe.
Well, you very well could have a point there. Very well could have a point. I think you've resonated with something really powerful, and it would probably take a whole show to talk about. In the second book, we had a chapter called The Return of the Watchers. We brought forward the idea that anciently there were some masters that came to the earth called watchers, fallen angels, if you will, and they didn't have man's best interests in heart. Although they weren't high in numbers, they had superior intellect and great experience, and they began to teach this to the world's leaders. And except for the fact that they didn't have a lot of high technology at their disposal, they were rather successful at trying to take over the world. Now we're in a little different situation. There is high technology on the earth. There is instantaneous communication on the earth. And we do have a way of exchanging our labor for something we call money, and then that money for something else, which has been the alchemical goal all along, is to find something worthless that they could make valuable. It used to be base metals, now it's worth even less than that, it's paper. So we're to the point now where it looks like the strategy of the watchers is being unfolded right before our eyes. And those of us that are aware, those of us that have read the book, that know what's going on, maybe we can posture ourselves where we're not taken out as someone who might be unaware would be. What do you think?
I think you're correct. And when you were talking about manifesting, it goes back to something that I'll get around to it. What I think is happening is because of these thoughts that you bring forth and other people bring forth, and we think about it, and those who think about it, and it resonates with them, it's actually changing something in us, spiritually.
Right, and, right.
What Edgar Cayce has said is that for anything to change, it has to change on the spiritual plane first before it manifests itself in the material world.
Mm-hmm.
So, like I have thought and said before, a lot of the things that I have read on Edgar Cayce, I see those things in other people's writings today, and they're being amplified and being more details being given, but it was the things that he said that back then that I see coming, and I'm so amazed by it. And how that, you know.
Well, what did you think of Edgar Cayce? I mean, did you think that he really was a sleeping prophet? Do you think that he made enough accurate predictions to be considered a prophet, or do you think he just made so many predictions he couldn't help but get a few right?
No, I discount the latter, because you could make a lot and you still not be right. There are some indications, I think, that he was tapping into I'll say the maybe he was tapping into the universal mind, or maybe the what do they call those? There's a
the collective consciousness.
Book of the book.
The Akashic Records.
The Akashic Records, where everything is in there. I mean, because he was able to diagnose people and give them what they should do, and he had some off the wall cures for the condition that they were in, and he made the point of saying that my cures. He said these things will make may not. He said they may eliminate the pain, but not cure the person, because he would be interfering in their, basically in the contract that they made when they came to Earth. Because I guess from different books that I've read, we have said that we were going to come to Earth and try to learn certain lessons, and that there are at least 3 points where we can leave this Earth, and it's basically up to us when we leave it. So, you know, a person doesn't have the knowledge that they made, the contract that they made in spirit, when they're going to leave and how they were going to leave. And so he was saying, basically, I can't, you know, override the agreement that they made, but I might be able to lessen the pain. And then he made predictions on the Earth changes that are coming. Now, some of the Earth changes have occurred, some of them haven't. But he said that the Earth changes that he saw, like he saw the destruction of Los Angeles, the destruction of the Eastern Seaboard, and New York, like you had mentioned. But he said Los Angeles would go first, and then New York. But he seems to indicate that there's a possibility that he mentioned a few possibilities for New York. He either said it was going to be a nuclear attack, or there was going to be a volcano, which there's a fault under New York, under the park there, their famous park, which I can't remember the name of. Or he said by water, one of those three things. He said that basically Florida was going back, most of it was going to be reclaimed because it was a marshy land anyway. He said a lot of the World War II battlefields would go underwater. He said that lands would also start to appear. He was talking about Atlantis in the Atlantic, and he said portions of Lemuria would appear in the Pacific.
Right. And I remember it was supposed to happen sometime in the 1968 or 69, and it was a big earthquake then, and then the Bimini Road was discovered, and, you know, in the Bahamas, and it looked like maybe his prediction might have come true, but nothing's really come of it in the last 40 years.
Well, there's a gentleman with the ARE, and the ARE was was set up by Edgar Cayce, and it's in Virginia Beach, Virginia.
Right.
And he there's a guy that actually has done some underwater dives in, I'm trying to remember where it was, I want to say Bermuda, and he has found a large, what looks like a seaport underwater, but it didn't make a lot of news. But if you go to ARE's website, he made a DVD, and he did some filming. I think he did underwater filming of it. So things are being found archaeologically. There have been a few others who have used his readings to take a look at I'm trying to remember the pyramids in Egypt, which Edgar Cayce said that there's basically a structure underneath the pyramids, and he was saying under the right paw of the Sphinx is where the records from Atlantis are, because they were saying some of the Atlanteans knew that their time was at an end, and basically the story behind that was, what I could gather is that there must have been a race of beings, but Casey doesn't identify them, but they helped them build the giant crystals. The giant crystal, which was able to capture the sun's energy, and they have other crystals that use the energy, and they used it for different things. They used it for flying ships. They used it for,
for regional power stations and everything, for electricity and for travel and for communications.
Right, he said that. Now, what he also said was that the Atlantis, who started out like Lemuria and Atlantis were spiritual, but Lemuria kept that spirituality, but the Atlanteans turned more toward the scientific, and they became more warlike, and they would send their armies around the world to conquer it. If they were being beaten, they would recall their armies and use the giant crystal to basically destroy the city, or destroy that area that they were trying to conquer.
Right.
The problem was, they went to China. Well, China is on the opposite side. And so what they did was they aimed the crystal to go through the earth, and they went to get the effect of the destruction of China on the other side. But what happened was it caused the buildup of gases in the earth, and it caused the an earthquake, and that's when a third part of the Atlantis sunk immediately, and then the other two-thirds sank after that, but the Atlanteans, with the two-thirds still there, they start putting their records around the world. They said that there's some in Egypt, and he mentioned somewhere in South America there's a record, and I think in China, but I can't remember where. So, and that, he said, and that's why, basically, when you, I connected what he said with the gases built up in the earth with, if there's ever an earthquake, they said there usually are lights in that area before the earthquake. And that is the gas escaping and being ignited by the piezoelectric effect.
Wow. Fascinating stuff.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I got into that because when I was younger, it was about, I think I was about 11 or 12, I wanted to find out what was going to happen in the future, so I started reading a lot of people who predicted the future, and I remember my mother said, well, you need to read this book by Edgar Casey. He predicted some things about the future, and basically that's when I got turned on to Edgar Casey and read several of his books. He talks not only about that, but he talks about Jesus, he talks about the Spirit. There are a lot of subjects that he covered, and if you read anything about him, he said that not all the stories in the Bible are true, but they were meant to, like the Aesop fables, they were meant to give you a roadmap. They were, moral ways to be, basically. And Casey.
Well, one of the things that I noticed about Casey, and there's no real detriment to him. But at some time in his life, and now he was asleep when he made most of his predictions, and he made the predictions for people who were very interested in what he was doing, it became apparent that his predictions, as they were being recorded and read back to him, revealed something that was not in line with his religious upbringing. And so he decided that he was going to stop seeing what he was seeing. He was going to shut off his own vision, and he dropped into a state of depression. what we try to do with the books when we put these together, and what we also try to do with this radio station, is maybe open people's eyes a little bit, not to shake their foundations or drop them into a state of depression, but to realize that indoctrination comes from all different points, including religious leaders. Religions are not infallible, and almost without exception, and in fact I would go so far as to say without exception, lead people in a direction of indoctrination rather than enlightenment.
I will agree with you. One of the things that I remember somebody saying is, basically when you believe in God, it's your belief, and whenever you go to a church and they tell you you must believe, then it stops being faith and becomes that indoctrination that you're talking about.
Sure.
So, you know, I agree with you, and basically, if people really read the Bible, in the New Testament, Jesus broke he basically said, you don't need anybody to talk to me. You have it within yourself to talk to me. So,
right.
But, you know, people want to point to going to church to do it, and that's, the church is not... is not, you know, takes nothing, your belief of Jesus or what he was teaching. It's just going there, I guess, to satisfy something that you've been, or that your parents have been doing for a long period of time.
Yeah,
exactly. To a belief that doesn't say anything.
Well, Lyle, I appreciate the phone call. I want to cover a little bit more in the next half hour. If you want to stand by and listen, I think we have a couple more callers we want to get to.
Okay.
Make a habit. Call in every week if you want to, because you've got a lot of great ideas, and you certainly have done your research, and we like talking to you.
All right. Will do.
All right. Thanks, Lyle.
Thank you. Bye.
Good night. I wanted to make sure that we cover a little bit of this human consciousness things before we get too far. I'm going to read you a story, and it's probably going to make you slap your knee or slap your forehead and say, wow, that exact same thing has happened to me. And it's kind of an anecdotal account, but it is really not that far off the mark. As far as I know, this story is true. On the evening of April 26th, and this is by an anonymous writer, I'm just going to read it the way that he wrote it. On the evening of April 16th, 2006, my family was seated around the kitchen table finishing an informal dinner when I suddenly experienced a strong desire for a cookie. Now, for one, I should tell you that I am the last person in my household to have cravings for sugar. I should also tell you that, unlike the rest of my family, I am the one who is known to be even-tempered. I experience the occasional mood swing, but I have always done well to keep my emotions in check. In other words, I very rarely raise my voice. That said, you can appreciate why it came as a complete shock to my family when I asked if we had any cookies in the house. And you can appreciate their second shock when, upon finding out that we didn't, I responded by angrily exclaiming, what? I was only joking, of course, but for a brief moment, my family wasn't so sure. I want cookies, I demanded. I want cookies, and I want them now, I said as I pounded my fist on the table for good measure, and that's exactly when the doorbell rang. Our glass front door is visible from the kitchen table, so when the doorbell rang, we all turned to see my wife's parents standing at the door. Kaylin, my youngest, immediately got up and ran to the door as I yelled after her, Kaylin, ask Grandma if she brought my cookies. I said it in such a way as to imply dire consequences if Grandma didn't have them with her, a threat which caused everyone to start laughing, including Kaylin, who was already giggling when she opened the front door. "Hi, Grandma. Daddy wants to know if you brought his cookies," she said. Of course, this set everyone into a fit of laughter. Even Grandma and Grandpa began to laugh as Grandma reached into her purse with a perplexed expression on her face and pulled out a large, unopened bag of oatmeal chocolate chip cookies. "I was at the store," she said, chuckling, "and there was a two-for-one special, so I bought you a bag." She handed the bag to Kaylin, who ran into the kitchen and set it down in front of me on my placemat. The brand name on the tag was Dad's Cookies. Now, this is the kind of coincidence that can happen. Coincidence or manifestation? How many times have you been driving down the highway, riding your bicycle, walking down the street, eating cookies and drinking milk, minding your own business, and all of a sudden, an old television episode of Twilight Zone comes to mind? "Gee, I remember this episode." Or an episode of The Rifleman, or Gunsmoke, or All in the Family, or even Full House. Something you haven't seen in years. In fact, it's probably the very last episode you saw of that program. How many times have you gone home that night, halfway through the bowl of popcorn, picked up the remote, hit it two or three times, passed the sci-fi channel, and lo and behold, that very episode of Twilight Zone is on? You've had it happen. Coincidence or manifestation? Back before we had call waiting, how many times have you heard the phone ring while you're doing dishes in the kitchen, quickly grab the rag, and before you even pick the receiver up, say, "What is my friend Dean doing calling?" And you pick up the phone and it's him. How many times has that happened to you? Coincidence or manifestation? Are we really a telepathic race and have forgotten how to do it on purpose? I remember one time I was shopping by myself, mind actively going away. I had purchased what I wanted and I was headed for the checkout counter. And you know, they always have these impulse buy things at the checkout counter. And lo and behold, on the left-hand side was a rack full of candy. And one of the selections was a Snickers bar. Now, I hadn't had a Snickers bar in a while, but man, right at that moment, I had a craving for a Snickers bar, and I almost reached for it. Instead, I emptied my small carry basket onto the conveyor belt, only three or four items, maybe worth $6 or $7. She rang up the total and said, "That'll be $9 and something," and I got the most puzzled look on my face. "How could it be that much for only three items?" She said, "Well, didn't you want the Snickers bar?" I, and there was no Snickers bar. It wasn't there. I had manifested that Snickers bar so powerfully that this cash register lady, this cashier, her mind idly doing her job unconsciously, had a photo of a Snickers bar put in her mind, and she rang it up, and it wasn't even there. Are we a telepathic race and have forgotten how to do it on purpose? We have gotten so used to forcing vibrations past two little muscles in our throat, vibrating the air and sending shaped sound waves across the air molecules in front of us to the little tympanic membrane of the person we're communicating with, whose brain has turned those vibrations into intelligible words and thus pictures, and understood what we're trying to say or what we're saying, to the point where we've forgotten how to telepathically move our messages from one person to another. Or have we? Or have we? Because how often have you said words to someone and had them react as though you said something quite opposite? Is it the way you said it? Is it the tone of your voice, the way you held your hands or your eyes, or whether you smiled or not? Is it your posture, your body language, the way you comb your hair? Or is it the telepathic message that you're really sending with your true self that they're picking up on? Are we really a telepathic race that has forgotten how to do it on purpose? Phone lines are open. We have about 20 minutes left. If you're out there and you have an idea about this, we would like to hear about it here. How many times have you telepathically sent a message to someone who is across town or across the state or across the country or even in another lifetime who has responded to you? Do we not pray? Do we not yearn and send our desires out into the universe? Do you not think that this is real, organized, intentional energy being sent out to the universe? I maintain that it is. And I maintain that there is matter and energy in this dimension and the next that responds to that intention. It responds to that telepathic energy. Remember, thoughts precede actions. So as a man thinketh, so is he. So how do you control your thoughts? I guess you don't really have to, do you? Just be who you are. If you don't like who you are, be what you want to be. What you want to be, you will be in the end. Our phone lines, toll free, U.S. 888-228-4494. Toll free in Canada. We have a lot of Canadian listeners out there. A lot of Canadians bought books over the last 2 weeks. Toll free, 877-489-6350. Anywhere else, on planet, off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us. 530-776-5154 or 530-776-5185. In wrapping things up tonight, don't forget Tesla Tech coming up July 31st through August 3rd. TeslaTech.info is the website. Click on the banner at X-Squared Radio, X2-Radio.com. And also, we want to apologize to those people out there who have radio archive subscriptions. We recently had our hosting company change servers. When they did so, they completely hosed our database. The program has been restored, and we are currently working through the graphics of the more than 200 hours of radio programs out there in our archives. If you have a past subscription, you still had time left on it, please email us, and we will restore your username and password, and you'll be able to get back in. For those of you that are just coming on, our subscriptions are really inexpensive, $2.50 if you want to listen for a month. If you want to listen for an entire year, it's only $20, less than the price of a cup of coffee per month. You get access to over 200 hours of some of the world's best experts in all kinds of subjects. We don't do ghost stories and we don't do conspiracy theories, the best of the best. If you want to listen for free, click on the iPod symbol, the podcast symbol with the headphones. We always have some choice programs in there that you can listen to an hour of for free. And we have many, many thousands of people that click on those and enjoy those. But the whole interview, the whole three-hour interview with each of these guests, nothing like it. Nothing like it. Okay, we have a caller on the line. Your first name and where you're calling from, please.
My name is John. I'm calling from Massachusetts.
Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Hi. You just mentioned something that's perplexed me for years, and maybe you can help. And it's happened to me all through the years. And what I want to know, what I've been trying to find out, is if it's a manifestation of something, those occurrences, or did you make it happen, or was it premonition? That's my problem.
That's a very good question. Lots of people have asked that question.
If you cause it to happen, then that's pretty powerful stuff.
Well, it's pretty powerful either way, but
you're right.
There are good physics explanations for both. One is, and every physicist knows this, that time is just a matter of distance. It is not really a forward and backward in time. It's just as far from here to San Francisco as it is from San Francisco to here. So all events happen all the time. Now, mathematically speaking, that's easy to think of. But when you think of the fact that I just looked at my watch 5 minutes ago and it was 5 minutes ago, I can't go back, you know, physically in time. Mentally, maybe I can. And maybe mentally I can go forward in time. So the idea is that the fact that the event is going to happen and I see it going to happen, and then it happens. Is it a premonition or did I manifest it? Well, when you imagine something in the future or when something comes to you, it's quite different. If you're just walking down the street, like I said, eating cookies and drinking milk and something pops into your mind, that's probably the manifestation of someone else that you're picking up on coming into your mind. You no more manifested the next episode of Twilight Zone than did, you know, the neighborhood cat. But the person who did the program scheduling did manifest it. And that resonation went out in the universe, and you were primed to get the message. So the real power behind it is exactly what you thought. If you are unconsciously going through the world and having these premonitions or realizing that, gee, that's a coincidence, I was just thinking about that, you're not conscious that you're conscious. But if you're conscious that you're conscious and you really know that what you think about does resonate with the universe and can be made to happen, especially if two or three people concentrate on the same thing, now the idea is to awaken and try to do it on purpose.
Yes,
this is exactly the secret behind the law of attraction and for generating wealth in your life.
Right. And that's my goal. That's my quest. And I'm working on. You know, the thing that I notice when I meditate, when I go to work, I travel about half hour a day. And if I meditate on the way, you know, not closing my eyes, naturally I'm driving. But, you know, if I think of the present, it's amazing how those lights will turn green, and it's like the Red Sea parting, cars get out of my way. It's just an amazing thing.
Wow, that's really powerful, because the people coming from sideways, they're trying to manifest green too, but they're getting red.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
So you must be a pretty powerful being.
No, whether I'm just at the right place at the right time, or, you know, whatever process that is, but I know it happens on a regular basis, so there's something to that.
Well, that's the process of resonation, my friend. It's what we were talking about earlier in the program. It's sort of like playing the game of tetherball. It doesn't take much energy to just tap that ball at exactly the right time to get a tremendous amount of energy and return. And what you seem to be able to do is naturally find the rhythm of your life, so that you're in the zone.
Right, exactly. That's the way I think about it, being in the zone.
Well, now let me ask you a question. I ask this question quite often, maybe not on the program, but when I'm interviewing for books. What's your dream?
Right now my dream is to attain a higher level of enlightenment. I've been getting into the Bible, you know, very much. I mean, it's something I've always done since I was a little kid, but I kind of got away from it for a while. And I got into that, and then even beyond that, looking at the essence of what's being taught in the Bible in terms of what we now know today through science, and thinking in terms of light and energy and frequencies, and all those things, I believe. Now, the Bible, you can understand, I've heard as much as 7 levels, but I know at least 3 levels you can understand the Bible. And I think a lot of those things are so profound, but they're written in such a way that you could probably tell it to a young child. But I think there's so much power there, and what we're understanding now through science is revealing some of those profound statements that God talked about and Jesus talked about. And
John, let me ask you a question. Let me ask you a question, John. The Bible is a fantastic collection of writings over a period of time from a myriad of writers, assembled in order of size, at least in the New Testament, and the Old Testament's maybe a little bit more, got more copies out there, so we're pretty sure we have the right translation. What part of that collection of writings resonates the most with you? What particular aspect? What story? What situation?
Well, there's 2 aspects. One is just my study of the church and how it evolved. You know, that is what it is. But I think Genesis is the one I keep coming back to. The story of creation and the story of just the energy of creation, I guess.
Well, you know, that's very interesting, because when you go back and look at the ancient civilizations, the Mayans, the Zapotecs, the Egyptians, the Sumerians, even the doggone Indians, and the Eskimos and Navajos, that's the exact story that they concentrate on the most, is that story of creation. It's what they teach in their temples. It's the oldest, most rehearsed story in any record, even the Zohar.
Wow.
So it's amazing that you keyed in on that, and the fact that the planet is getting to a point where we're ending the age of Pisces, we're beginning the age of Aquarius, and we're nearing an area of our galaxy with our solar system, and it seems like the energy that's in this region of the universe resonates with sleeping DNA that we have.
Uh-huh.
Some of us have a lot of it, some of us have very little of it, but it seems to be turning switches on inside of us. What do you think about that?
I can relate to that. Yeah, so it seems things that I wondered about a long time ago just seem to be becoming available now as far as being able to know these things.
Well, that's a fantastic realization. And I hope that as you're going down the highway each morning, going to work and resonating with these thoughts, that you're broadcasting that with your what seems to be very powerful manifestation mind to cars around you. And I hope they're picking up the same message of hope that you're talking about tonight, because we need it.
Well, you know, that's one of my goals. And it's just, you know, to spread those thought waves out. It's funny though, I tell you, I bump into people and you try and share this information and it's like throwing seeds down on a rock and like it's not fertile soil.
And yeah, exactly.
I get just so much opposition. I'm wondering, where is this person's head? You know? I don't know.
Well, you're exactly right.
You know, I wonder if there's people that just will not know it or just don't care to know it. They're just so locked up into their existence.
Well, it could be. And, you know, when we talk to people and we go over this in Volume 3 of The Ark of Millions of Years, we actually divided the book into 2 parts, because when we're studying 2012 and all the cataclysms coming and storms and earthquakes and upheavals and tidal waves and everything, it gets kind of doom and gloom. So we had to finish the book on a positive note, so we decided to section out section 2 or volume 2, or section 2 of volume 3. And we talk about this ability to manifest a different future, this ability to awaken, to actually have an ascension experience where you leave the old, asleep, doubting, dark person behind and you become a being of light.
Yes. Now, will those souls come together even though you're not physically, you know, in the same location? Will that mind transcend,
Here's what I see. I do see them gathering. When I go to different conventions, I even go to the mall. I see them, enlightened people of light, coming together. And it's so amazing because I know this really sounds funny, but you're even seeing them repair up. Even if they've had relationships with someone else for a long, long time from an earthly standpoint, all of a sudden there's like a reshuffling going on. Kids and parents and grandparents and families and moving, and even companies are making changes and mergers and everything. It's all this energy lining up with resonance. It's really fascinating to watch.
Wow. Well, you know, it's great to be part of that, and you know, if you just break it down to two forces in you know, the universe, good and bad, you know, so cool to be part of the good part, you know, the positive part anyway. You know.
Well, believe in that, and realize that the thoughts that you have and the manifestations that you're putting out do affect the universe. Everything you do will eventually affect the universe.
Right. Well, you know, thank God for BBS because I'm learning so much on this station. And this is the time I bumped into your program, but, you know, I'm going to listen to you every week. So
it is great, and we love BBS Radio. They're the best internet radio hosting system on the net, bar none.
I believe it. Well, thank you for taking the time and speaking with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, John, and stay warm this winter up there in Massachusetts, and tell a friend about us, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, good night.
Bye-bye.
Okay, Earth Explorers, we have about 2 minutes left. In that time, I just want to let you know that the special that we offered on Coast to Coast on the 2nd of July, we are extending to all BBS radio listeners up until August 2nd, that gives you roughly a week and a half, to purchase the third volume of The Ark of Millions of Years, and we will send you a link to the audiobook of Volume 1 and Volume 2 for free as a bonus. That's a $40 value added for free to your purchase of Volume 3, and we will also autograph Volume 3 for you. So you'll have all three volumes, about 1,600 pages of information. Two volumes read to you in audio and one that you can do plenty of coloring in the margins. There are 189 pictures in this book. It is very well done. Lots of people like it. It is in the top 100 on Amazon. We think you should have a copy and we think you should be able to listen to the other two volumes. So, to do that, there are a couple ways to do this. One is, of course, you can buy it off our website at x2-radio.com. The other way is you can go to arcofmillionsofyears.com, and you can click on one of the six buttons on the left-hand side, and all the posted solutions are there for U.S. buyers, both soft and hard covers, Canadian, European, and United Kingdom customers have a second pricing, postage has already been figured for you, and our friends down in Australia and New Zealand, lots and lots of books sold down there in the last couple weeks. We have postage solutions for you as well. All the books will be autographed, shipped out, and you will get the audio version of Volumes 1 and Volume 2 for free, but only up till August 2nd. So, go ahead and pick up your copy of The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 3, Unlocking the Secret. We appreciate you being with us tonight. It has been our pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Please tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 5 p.m. Pacific Time, we provide the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your radio station and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Look for the good in people and try to make it grow a little every day. And before long, you will change the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying peace, Earth Explorers.